Sila, Butzamesk, Entru, and Lutatsia. I know, you're saying to yourself, same to you and more of it, right? That's in Romanian, that means a good day. Thank you for the invitation. That's a bit. In fact, I love their language so much in Romania that when you say thank you, they say cherry. What a nice word. You're welcome. Makes me want to eat a cherry pie. I mean, it's so good. It's just such a romantic, beautiful language. And it's, they have more syllables than the Italian language, and they can go on and on in a very verbose way. When they could have said the same thing, just once. And the name God, it's got like four syllables, and it's like something like 10 characters, and it's incredible. I can't even say it, but God is just three letters. But that's the way it works. I want to take you immediately to Dwight Nelson's newsletter that he wrote just Wednesday. How many of you heard last week, not this last week, but the week before last, just right after I got home from Romania, that the North Carolina legislature, some congressmen there, proposed a bill to allow North Carolina to establish their own favored state church for taxation? And it was put forward, regardless of your party affiliation or whatever, it was put forward by Republican Tea Party members who basically wanted to turn the clock back to the state church. It was really bizarre. And after that, some polls were taken in the United States regarding should the United States Constitution be amended to allow for the Christian religion to be the favored religion of the nation. In other words, to make our nation a Christian nation by law. Which, if you look in contrast, if you look at Sharia law in Islamic countries, to make them Muslim countries by law, which we just shudder at horror, and yet we would turn around and do the same thing. It's kind of hypocritical, isn't it? Here's what Dwight Nelson had to say. It was amazing to me. And I found this on Facebook. He wrote this. He said, "This week we learned one out of three Americans would like to see Christianity established as the official religion of this nation. Let the moral or immoral conditions of our society continue to deteriorate, and it isn't rocket science to assume such numbers will only increase. Let a series of national calamity strike us, and I imagine a majority hue and cry for a state-sponsored religion, i.e. return this country to God, would no doubt be the moniker for such a move." He goes on, he says, "The point? You can get there from here, which means that from here on out, vigilance on behalf of religious liberty is critical." I say amen to that. Because if more than a third of our country is in favor of Christian nation status, and if you consider that our country is moving rapidly towards increased godlessness and immorality, whether it be issues such as abortion, gay marriage, and we see it not just creeping on us, but rushing upon us, it seems, as I discovered in Romania, as secularism increases, with it comes this sense of loss of power by Christian leaders. And they say, we must do everything we can to turn back the tide. And what mechanism did they use to try to turn back the tide? They tried to use laws. They tried to use laws that would enforce the way of right and morality. And where does that lead us? It leads us towards impatience. It leads us towards a lack of discernment and wisdom, even with their own myths. And it causes us many times to be blind in the name of patriotism. We become emotional and we support that which would actually enslave us and take away our religious freedoms. It's ironic, because as I have stated many times in my sermons in the past and in my articles for Liberty Magazine and elsewhere, we are susceptible of following along with the fickle will of the masses with very little understanding of where we're going. I would like to have you turn in your Bibles to Revelation 17, verses 12 to 14, because I would like to take our attention away from the national scene in the United States here, and I would like us to look at the global scene, because I am discovering a certain phenomenon that I have been watching for several years now, and it's increasing. And it has to do with blasphemy law proposals, both internationally and at the UN Commission on Human Rights at the United Nations. And I would like to focus on that in our understanding of last day events. I was going to present to you a sermon paralleling the events of the Christ trial, the crucifixion, with current events before I came here. But after my international trip in Romania, I kind of lost my enthusiasm for that particular presentation. And I want to share with you what is happening globally. Foreign policy is my favorite subject of study when I'm at the office and at home and wherever I go. And so if you're not used to understanding foreign policy, or if you feel like I'm going over your head, please hang in there with me. I don't want you to give up on me, because what I'm about to share with you is vitally important to understand in terms of where we are going. And I want to warn you up front, I'm an equal opportunity offender. So I say that because it's important to understand with religious freedom, we're dealing with legal issues, political issues, and religious issues all in one swoop. And you know what they say, in conversation with impolite company, you should never discuss what? Politics, religion, or law. Well, I'm in that unenviable position as your religious liberty leader for the Union Conference, which I've been doing for 15 years, and I've been very thankful. I believe that the interfaith movement, what I call the interfaith left, is just as much of a threat to religious freedom as the Christian right. So remember that. And many of you may not understand what I'm talking about. The Christian right would do away with the separation of church and state. They would basically minimize the establishment clause, so it means basically that you have a right to believe and worship as you please. But in the end, we have a right to favor a national church or a state church through taxation. We have a right, basically, to outlaw all kinds of things in the name of God and morality, which is, you know, it's all good. So good, wonderful, but where does it lead? I often tell people, I mean, if you look at a Sunday law, what motivates a Sunday law? In fact, if you look at a national Sunday law or a Sunday law, it becomes nationalized. When you nationalize something, that's a form of socialism. Sunday laws, ironically, coming from the right, is a form of socialism. So if you think socialism only comes from the left, I want to wake you up to something. It comes from the right as well. And it's for me, it's a no-brainer, but it oftentimes is hard to understand that. The interfaith left, which oftentimes is associated with the political left, is equally dangerous to religious freedom, and I would argue even more so as we go along in the presentation. If you're with me in Revelation 17, I'm going to turn on my little smartphone here. Get Revelation 17 up. We'd like to walk you through some things about Revelation 17 that you may not have been aware of. It's a very difficult passage. And it's not easy to understand. The 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but for 1 hour will receive They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will wage war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. Amen? Isn't that beautiful? It's a beautiful passage. But it puts forward the great controversy in miniature, like no other passage in Scripture. And it is loaded with prophetic earmarks that we must pay attention to. And the first one, of course, is the ten horns. Now, how many of you know what the ten horns are? Anybody have a clue? Tell me. Go ahead. I'm listening. The ten kings, right? Ten kings. You have, let's go even further back to more basic, so the children can understand this. You have the image in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, Daniel chapter 2, right? And you have Rome, you have Medo-Persia, you have Greece, thighs, and you have the legs of iron representing Rome. And then you've got the feet and the ten toes. And the ten toes, and I used to say when I was a kid, yeah, you go down to the toenails, and we're right at the end of time, right at the toenails. You know, right at the end, we're about ready to fall off into the ocean there, the toenails. If any of you remember that image of Nebuchadnezzar, he's kind of standing on a platform or a rock, and the ocean is surrounding him. And of course, we're told in Daniel 2 that these kingdoms will fall by the wayside, because a rock cut out without hands will come and smite the image and destroy it. It represents the second coming of Christ, and it takes his redeemed home, and so on and so forth. We all know the scenario. Well, those ten toes are akin to the ten horns in Daniel 7. And out of those ten horns comes up a what? A little horn. Okay? And that little horn is who? Rome, the papacy, the Vatican, the Holy Roman Empire, as we have known about it. The empire that covered a 1260-year prophetic time period from 538 AD to 1798 AD. From the time of Justinian, when he united the Roman Empire together, east and west, and till 1798, when Napoleon captured Pope Pius VI, put him in jail, brought him to die, and emerged. What emerged from that? Who emerged from that was Pope Pius VII in the College of the Cardinals, and we know the rest of the story. Well, in Revelation 17 here, the ten horns, representing ten kings, we have often referred to them as Europe. Now, if we go and look at the history of Europe, and as it has emerged, we know them as the European Union right now. Okay? But if we look at these ten kings, and especially if we look at these ten horns, if they indeed represent ten kings, who are they representing? Do they just represent here in Revelation 17 something that is the same as the kings of Europe or the kingdoms of Europe? Or is it something that's bigger globally? Does it have a international perspective here? Is it just describing Europe here? Is Europe a player? Yes, Europe is a player. I often describe it as the G8 or the economic elite or the G20, which it has increased to. You have the G8 you see on TV sometimes, the leading nations of the world. Ellen White, in Early Writings, page 282, refers to them as the leading men of the earth, which is very interesting. So if you look at the G20, then you have the emerging nations of Brazil, India, Indonesia, Argentina, and other countries. You see that it has to be something that's larger. If there's an international order that's to come, it has to be larger than just ten horns or ten kings. Do you follow me? So the ten kings here, or the ten horns, you saw our ten kings, has to be something larger. And who do they unite with? Who do they follow? It says, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast? And this is interesting, because most political scientists are saying that the United States is declining, And as it declines and the rest of the world sort of comes together, even though the United States will, they argue that the United States will continue to be the world leader, but that the other nations are becoming more powerful, especially with economic free trade and so on. And we've seen that happen. We've seen nations emerge. And so as nations emerge, along with the United States, we end up with this description here, a global description. Now, who is the beast here? The beast here is very important to understand, because the beast here is the same beast as Revelation 13, verses 11 to 15. It's, according to Adventist scholars, and I haven't seen an Adventist scholar disagree with this yet, this is the United States of America, not Rome, at least not, and I don't want to confuse you here, because in this verse it actually is both the United States and Rome. Now, how do we know that? How do we know that the beast power here is the United States and Rome? Well, if you study Revelation 17, most of the chapter is focused on Rome and the history of Rome and how it controlled the kings, emperors, and coerced it, manipulated it, and dominated kings and emperors for a 1260-year period. Revelation 17 is focused on that. And you have the eight kings at the end of Revelation 17. I had several people come up to me in Romania, and even in the United States before I left. Well, you know, the election of the Pope, that's... And we're going to talk about the Pope here, and the election of the Pope, because it's all part of the scenario of the United States, Rome, and Europe, as I continue on with my talk. But the suggestion was, well, this will be the last Pope. And I said, yeah, you know, it's interesting because from the time of Martin Luther on, they kept predicting that the next Pope would be the last Pope. So I don't take that very seriously. And I don't get all excited about that and worked up over that. I just don't. For one, this Pope was elected even older at the beginning of his reign than Benedict was, who was elected at the age of 76. And this Pope, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, Archbishop and Cardinal from Buenos Aires, Argentina, is 78. So, and he has half of a lung, two lungs, but half of one lung. And the Vatican, they say, well, that's not very serious, but you can't really trust what the Vatican tells you these days. Anyway, so the point is that he's how long is he going to last? Who knows? He could last 20 years. We don't know. I have no idea, and I'm not going to speculate. But the point is, all your political scientists and church watchers and other people are saying, this guy is, yeah, he's very popular. He's trying to restore the legacy of John Paul II with an ecumenical appeal to all religions, especially Islam, which I will talk about in a minute, which is crucial to what I'm going to be sharing, and how things are shaping up internationally and prophetically. But you have to understand that he is going to be limited as to what he can actually do during the time period he has with whatever help he has left. And I don't want to discourage the elderly. Vigorous and strong, and most even in science, that the Lord is somehow counting them out. And young people, I've always, my grandpa died in 1899, and I learned from a young age that wisdom lies in the hands of older people. And it's best that you listen to them. So much wisdom, many years, much experience benefited me over the years. So I hope it benefits you as well. Don't run from it. Don't disrespect it. The beast. Oh, you know, since I was a kid, we talked about the beast. And, you know, it's kind of, it got my attention, but it's also turned me off over the years. But I've become a more serious student about prophecy over the years, and the beast here is both the United States and Rome here. How do we know that? How do we know that it, when it says the beast, that it can describe two entities? Because in Revelation 13, verses 11 to 15, I don't have time to go over that with you, but let me just share this briefly with you. When the lamb-like beast emerges in verse 11, the beast Vatican, the Holy Roman Empire, during the 1260-year time period. And then we knew that in verse 10, it says, he who wields the sword must die by the sword. He who pretends to be both a church and a state must die by the sword. He's going to wield the sword, he's going to die by the sword. Meaning that when he receives that mortal wound, he would be stripped of its state powers, of its political powers, that the Church of Rome would just become only the Church of Rome and no longer have sovereign national powers recognized by the rest of the world. That's what happened in 1798. When it received a mortal wound, Pope Pius VI was captured by Napoleon, the ambassadors and envoys from other countries were removed, and the Vatican envoys of the other countries were brought back home, which completely stripped them of the political power. That wasn't restored until 1929 with the Lateran Treaty with Mussolini and Italy, where its papal states were restored and its sovereign nation state status was restored. Its status with the United Nations was eventually restored, and so on and so forth. It became both a church and a state, which the Vatican is the only entity that is represented that way. Are we, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, represented as both a church and a state? No. Praise God. We must be single-minded about our mission. But Rome, its membership is, what was it, 2 billion people. Islam with 1.3 billion people. And so it's the largest religion in the world. And of course, it has many adherents, so therefore it has lots of power. So it's given permanent status at the United Nations. Revelation 13, verse 12, it goes on and talks about this alliance, this collusion between this lamb-like beast and the first beast. And you can read that on your own. But it says that its wound is healed. Well, who wounds that? Who heals that wound? It's the United States. It reaches hands across the Gulf. It appoints the first permanent ambassador to the Vatican under Ronald Reagan in 1984. And part of that healing was Vatican II, clearly. And the ecumenical thrust and ministry of Pope John Paul II clearly restored Rome's focus and power. And since then, it's kind of hit a speed bump in the eyes of the world with the pedophilia scandals and so forth. Well, so if they come together, the rest of Revelation 13 then presents a twofold power, and then in verse 13 you bring along spiritualism, and in Revelation 13 you have a threefold power that's united. Okay? So if you have a threefold union in Revelation 13, verses 11 and 15, part of that union is a twofold union representing Rome and the United States. So when you read Revelation 17, 12 to 14, you have to factor that the beast here is both the United States and Rome. You follow? You follow what I'm saying? I know it's hard to understand that, but you have to go back to Revelation 13 to understand that and throw that into the package here in Revelation 17. That's the way it works. Bob knows what I'm talking about. Mark knows what I'm talking about. When you talk about prophetic interpretation, you have to understand these things. And C. Mervyn Maxwell understood this in God Cares, in Revelation, his study of Revelation, and also Daniel. And if you go back and read those books, and this becomes very clear. So here, the ten horns are ten kings. They unite. Let's call these ten kings the global axis powers. Who would we say they are? Who are the G8? Who do we say the G8 are? Who are the leading nations of Europe? Britain, Germany, France. Okay? The three biggies. All right? All three nuclear powers, all three economic powers. All right? And then you have all the rest that's in the European Union, like 20 other nations, or 17, including Romania. And there's difficulties over there. European Union is having a hard time with certain of their member nation states, like Hungary, which suspended its Supreme Court the other day. And so the European Union is talking about, you know, slapping sanctions on them and trying to get them to come around. And Hungary, it was just a year ago that Hungary stripped all the status of all religions, saying you're illegal suspended both Parliament and the Supreme Court. And the European Union says, you can't do that. You got to have separation of powers in a democracy. This was just last year. So there's a lot of problems there in the European Union. We don't know how strong the European Union is going to be. But what we see here in Revelation 17, verse 12, is a loose confederacy of nations, not anyone really overpowering and strong, except for the United States, with the influence of Rome. That's why the United States and Rome is specifically emphasized here in verse 12. It says they have one purpose. They are united and will give their power and authority to the beast. How do they do this? What brings this world unity about? And I would like to suggest from my title that it comes from a global ecumenical threat to religious freedom. How does that happen? The most studied book by academics for the last 20 years was written by a scholar named Samuel Huntington, who's now deceased, from Harvard University. In the 80s, he predicted the fall of the Soviet Union, predicted the end of the Cold War. Okay? And this was in, like, I think it was 1986 he wrote this. And then in 1989, things started to unravel with the Berlin Wall falling. You had the Romanian Revolution. You had the Polish Revolution. You had all those revolutions. And then even the Soviet Union crumbling in 1991, 1992. Well, Samuel Huntington was then viewed by the academic world internationally as well as nationally as this grand guru. How did you know all that? And so they persuaded him to finally write all of his thoughts and produce it in the book. First, it was produced in Foreign Affairs Journal, and then later in the book that won the Pulitzer Prize, called The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order. And this book has been so well studied, especially by presidents, and especially by President Obama, and President Barack Obama. And let me just read to you what it says. You can start to turn down the lights now, since we're kind of through with the scripture passage. Okay? This will help you. He says, world politics is entering a new phase. Remember, he wrote this in 1983. In which the great divisions among humankind and the dominating source of international conflict will be cultural. Remember, cultural means talking religious to a large degree. Civilizations, he writes, the highest cultural groupings of people are differentiated from each other by religion, history, language, and tradition. These divisions are deep and increasing in importance. From Yugoslavia to the Middle East to Central Asia, the fault lines of civilization are the battle lines of the future. In this emerging era of cultural conflict, the United States must forge alliances with similar cultures and spread its values wherever possible. With alien civilizations, the West must be accommodating if possible, but confrontational if necessary. In the final analysis, however, all civilizations will have to learn to what? Tolerate each other. Interesting. Forget about the full guarantee of freedom. Forget about democracy. We just have to tolerate each other. Which is interesting. Down below, I say that consensus by diplomacy and force is the very essence of the domestic and foreign policy doctrines of tolerance and peaceful coexistence. I wrote two articles in Liberty Magazine last year. The first one was entitled An Olive Branch Doctrine, Religion and the Path of Democratic Reform in the Arab Muslim World. I originally titled it Obama's Olive Branch Doctrine, and how his whole emphasis in foreign policy was to appease the Muslim world. And in a second article, I wrote the following, the two-part series, was merely tolerable, interfaith tolerance and the reshaping of U.S. foreign policy. And in here, I talked about his three speeches that he gave while early in his presidency in Egypt, then in Turkey, and then in Indonesia, 2010. And in each place, he was referring to how we could reform the Arab Muslim Middle East, and Indonesia, and he kept citing the Indonesian constitution called Pancasila. That's the name of their constitution. It's a 5-point constitution, which can be summarized by the following. Peaceful coexistence, which is the essence of their constitution. Now, what do they mean by peaceful coexistence? They mean this. Remember, in Indonesia is the largest the largest Muslim country in the world. It dwarfs the Muslim following in the Arab Middle East. Okay? Two-thirds of Muslim peoples in the world are in Indonesia. Okay? Not in the Middle East. It's a fact that you don't understand. But now you understand it. Okay? And it's important because Indonesia, pretty much any reforms that take place usually go through Indonesia first. But we don't pay much attention to Indonesia in the news, do we? I do, because without understanding Indonesia and where they're going, we can't understand where the Muslim world is going in the Arab Middle East. Pancasila means this. It means religious tolerance instead of the full guarantee of religious freedom. What it means is if you put all the religions in one room, okay, let's say you put all the religious leaders in one room, nobody could share their faith in that room unless you got permission from every single one in that room. Let's say all agreed. So I call it collective censorship. That's what it's essentially called, if you think about that. And it's the interfaith model. I belong to the Interfaith Council of Greater Portland. I belong to the Interfaith Council of Greater Seattle. I sit on the board of Portland. And that's a fact. You don't share your faith even in a circle, or let alone outside that circle among their cohorts and their followers, unless you were censured. You would be censured in that group for doing so. And it's the same thing with their blasphemy laws in Indonesia, is if you share your faith, you're liable for prosecution, punishment, and possibly even death in Indonesia. You have a right to peacefully coexist. You have a right to believe. You have a right to worship. But you don't have a right to share your faith. To proselytize, I found out in Romania, means to force or to coerce. In Eastern Europe, and as you go farther east into the Middle East and into the Asian countries, it means to force. To proselytize in America means to merely share, to share your faith, to evangelize in a free marketplace of ideas. They don't understand that concept of the free marketplace of ideas in those countries. They're still, even though they're emerging as dynamic economies, when it comes to culture and religion, they haven't quite made that crossover step into applying it to culture and religion, from economics to their cultural ways of living, which is fascinating to me. But it also suggests, based upon what Samuel Huntington writes in this book, and this is the big argument, so follow me here. Here's the big argument that he makes. He said, you know, all the nations that are at the United Nations sign on, if they want to become a member, to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And there it says that every individual in their country must be guaranteed the right to not only believe, to practice their faith, but also to share their faith. And Sandy Huntington says, most countries don't uphold that. We all know that. They don't allow the sharing of faith. They uphold their blasphemy laws. Anybody that says anything about another religion is put in jail. So if you were to evangelize on Revelation, using Revelation or Daniel, and we do over in these countries, but we do it at our own risk, by the way, including in India, we come under scrutiny of their blasphemy laws, because to say anything bad about another religion, or to say something that might hint at negativity historically about those religions or even contemporary says that this clash of civilizations is representative of this very fact, that the Western world, the United States and Europe, believes in a high constitutional standard that guarantees religious freedom by law. Okay? That's reflected in the First Amendment to the United States Constitution and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which I will read to you in a minute. And then the rest of the world, that even though they've signed on to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, most of those countries aren't even upholding it, including those countries in Central and South America. Okay? I did a whole study at Baylor University on all the countries in South America. They are not even coming close to upholding that law. Even though Protestantism and Pentecostalism is booming in those countries, there's still a lot of persecution down there by the Catholic Church of Protestants. So, what he argues is that if there's going to be world peace, if we're going to achieve world peace, and his grand opus, his grand thesis, and his clash of civilizations and the remaking of world order, if we're going to have world peace, there must be international consensus. And the only way we can achieve international consensus is for the United States, the Western world, and the United Nations to take a step backwards in a consensus-forming way. That is, we have to go back from the full guarantee of religious freedom to mere tolerance. The doctrine of mere tolerance. What am I talking about? How can you relate to this? Let me take you back to the Puritan era, before the constitutional founders came along. You had basically the same thing. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony, you had what was called blasphemy laws. Those blasphemy laws basically said this to the Puritans. They said, you Quakers, you Catholics, you Jews, you whoever, you have a right to peacefully coexist with us. Okay? But you do not have a right to proselytize us. Okay? And if you do, we will fight you. We will punish you. Maybe fine you, torture you, and kill you. Well, guess what? They said the same thing to their own Puritan members of the Congregational Church. They said, you must maintain your faith, and if you change your faith, that's unlawful. You cannot change your faith. It's the same problem in the international world with Indonesia. And there's all kinds of persecution. I'm constantly getting news reports every day, like Google Alerts, of persecution, people killed, Christians especially. And it's amazing that the world isn't paying attention to this. And so, the Puritans said, you must maintain your faith. If you change your faith, you're subject to imprisonment, fines, punishment, torture, possibly death. Okay? That was the Massachusetts Bay Colony. We emerged from that. And yet the world is trying to go force the United States and Europe and the Western world, the global powers, global access powers that we read about in Revelation 17, to go back to that. So the problem is, when Obama went to Egypt and Turkey and Indonesia, he praised the Indonesian constitution, saying that it was the best thing possible for the Middle East. It would lead to democratic reform. The problem with that, it was naive. Hillary Clinton had to basically rein it in, when she was Secretary of State, to say, what you stated was, you know, seemingly nice to praise them, but it's naive, because what it does is it sets up the rest of the world community to follow along. What if the rest of the world starts developing this approach of having blasphemy laws? And President Obama quickly turned around and reiterated that the United States opposes attempts by the Organization of Islamic Countries, 57 nations of Islamic countries. They have been trying to amend Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights for the last 5 years to include blasphemy laws, to say that you do not have a right to proselytize, you do not have a right to evangelize, you do not have a right to share your faith. They've been unsuccessful. The United States has officially opposed them, so has the Vatican. But things have been changing a little bit. And what Obama did was naive, but it was also something that President Bush, under Condoleezza Rice, was leaning towards. It was also what Bill Clinton before him was leaning towards. So it's been a trend. It's been a trend. And it's been an alarming trend to me, as I follow foreign policy. Now let's shift. Let's shift a little bit and understand what's going on in the rest of the world. Russia, just this week, this April 10, 2013, Russian Parliament moves ahead on anti-blasphemy measures. You've heard of the Pussy Riots, where the girls went into Russian Orthodox Church and kind of created mayhem and singing and playing the rock and roll and according to the Orthodox, desecrated their temple. And you kind of got a feel for the Orthodox Church there. I'm sure they were greatly offended, as they would have been in Romania or any other Eastern European country. There would be a jail and a fine of $10,000 or more for the bill. And the bill covers Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and Buddhism. But if you offend any of those religions, you would be facing those fines under their new blasphemy laws. Egypt, with their new, under the Arab, so-called Arab Spring, has their own blasphemy laws under Sharia law. And the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom says those must end, or you will lose economic support from the United States and the European community. That was a report on April 5. Now let me take you to something that is just as big, if not bigger. But there's been some troubling signs in the Vatican of late, and it might have been due to the weakness of Pope Benedict's papacy. But there seems to be some other indicators. What I'm about to share with you is possibly only speculation, but it is, I think, serious enough to warrant sharing with you today. In September 24 of last year, Pope Benedict XVI visited Lebanon. When he visited Lebanon, on that day, something occurred at the same time that day. In Los Angeles, a movie was produced called The Innocence of Muslims that mocked Muhammad. It created riots all over the Middle East, all over North Africa. Hundreds were killed. And it led to a green light for Al-Qaeda in Libya to storm the American embassy and kill the U.S. ambassador in Libya. Studies I'm reading And but they both made war on Marxist liberation theology in South America and Central America all through the late 70s and all through the 1980s. And they crushed this movement, literally crushed it. And who inspired it and who was behind it the whole time? The Jesuits. They made war on one of their own orders because the Jesuit order was stirring up this Marxist liberation theology movement all through Latin and South America. Well, it was Jorge Murillo Bergoglio, Archbishop of Buenos Aires, a Jesuit who made war on his own order and has even been accused of complicity of the death of two Jesuit Catholic priests and the deaths of many Marxist liberation members within the Catholic Church. And this is not, this story is not going away. It was in the BBC this week, it was in the New York Times this week. It just keeps kind of holding on to the new Pope, who denies it all, and he may be right. I don't know. I'd want to give him the benefit of the doubt, but at the same time, I lean with the stories, because whether he did it or whether he was complicit or whether he was not is not my point. The larger point I'm trying to make to you is that this idea, watch out for the, you know, because he's the first Jesuit pope, I say, well, then why did he take on the name of Francis? Why did he take on the name of the Jesuit priest of the Jesuit order? You have to understand, and I just read an article on this last week, how there needs to be another Council of Nicaea so that we can unite the orders of the Catholic Church, the Benedictine order, the Franciscan order, the Dominican order, the Jesuit order, and whatever other orders out there, Opus Dei order. And that, let me share one other thing with you on that point. When Pope John Paul II was making war on the Marxist liberation theology movement, and specifically on the Jesuit order in his own church, He had a ceremony. I have this article. I didn't bring this. I need to get it. It's in my files at my office. 1984, U.S. News and World Report, whole one-page article on the emergence of the Opus Dei and Pope John Paul II's big ceremony. Basically, and the article brought up the Marxist liberation theology, saying that in the Pope's crushing liberation Marxist theology, he was sending a message to Jesuits. And he was sending a message saying that I have ordained the Opus Dei, a lay-led disciplinary movement, to create law and order within their own church, a very capitalist-type organization, even though it began in Spain, to slap back this Marxist liberation theology movement. It was at the same time that Pope John Paul was joining hands with Reagan to end communism both in Poland and the Soviet Union. So they go together. But this Jorge Murillo Bergoglio, who's now Pope Francis I, is all part of that. And the news report, New York Times, BBC, and elsewhere, all pointing that out, that there's a specific statement that's being made by this new Pope that not only is he different from all the different regal popes of the past, he's simple, he's sort of like a modern Mother Teresa in his approach, and most of all, and this is finally bringing us back to what we're talking about here, is that the Pope is a huge proponent of restarting dialogue, ecumenical dialogue with Islamic leaders. In 2005, when Pope Benedict XVI was elected, his first speech that he gave was in Regensburg, Germany. In that speech, he cited King Mehmet, and he quoted King Mehmet as saying that Islam is inherently violent and evil. Okay? Then he went on the rest of the speech to say that that's not true. There's a lot of rational Muslims out there, and of course the rest of the Muslims Marino Bergoglio of Buenos Aires, Argentina, rebuked Pope Benedict XVI, and almost lost his seat on the College of Cardinals. Now, that's interesting, because now he's the Pope, and he wants to revive that dialogue with Muslims. My question is, will that fervor, that passion that he has to restore that dialogue between the Vatican and Muslims, Christianity and Islam, does that draw him to then change policy at the Vatican to approve of blasphemy laws and the amendments of Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? We see a trend, presidents? I'm asking a question about the Vatican, which has traditionally opposed blasphemy laws, at least in the last 5 years. But we know their history. The Catholic Church's history is, why not? Sure, of course we would be for blasphemy laws. That's their natural leaning and tendency. Okay? So factor those two things together. Okay? Let's look at some laws. This is basically the Church of Acts that we're going to that's a lot to try to bring in. It's basically everything that I've covered. We've got four categories here, and I'm trying to get to the last category. The First Amendment to the United States Constitution says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment, establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And in Article 6, Section 3, it says no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust of the United States. That's the high standard of the United States Constitution. And by the way, no other nation on earth has that high standard. But before we get there, what does it mean? What does it mean? What does religious freedom mean in the United States? Here's what a Supreme Court justice wrote. I can get it here. Justice Hugo Black in 1947, a case called Everson versus Board of Education. The court ruled 9-0. They said neither a state nor the federal government can set up a church. Right? You can pass laws which aid one religion, aid all religions, and prefer one religion. This is interesting language because the Romanian Orthodox flatly reject this type of language. Neither can force nor influence a person to go to or to remain away from church against his will or force him to profess a belief or disbelief in any religion. No person can be punished for entertaining or professing religious beliefs or disbeliefs for church attendance or non-attendance. No tax in any amount, large or small, can be levied to support any religious activities or institution, whatever they may be called, or whatever form they may adopt to teach or practice religion. Neither a state nor the federal government can openly or secretly participate in the affairs of any religious organization or groups, and vice versa. In the words of Thomas Jefferson, the clause against establishment of religion by law was intended to erect a wall of separation between church and state. That's what the Supreme Court ruled in 1947. That, whether you agree with that statement or not, has been the mantra of the Supreme Court and of U.S. law ever since. Well, that's a pretty high standard. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, otherwise known as International Religious Freedom, Article 18 says the following. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change his religion. Now, if you have the freedom to change your religion or belief, that means you also have the freedom to receive a spoken message from someone, or to read a tract or material from some other persuasion in order for you to change your religious belief. It doesn't just come out of revelation or an epiphany. Okay? So, thinking that and drawing this up, Eleanor Roosevelt, 1948, when she brought the United Nations together and formed the Human Rights Commission, this is what they agreed to, and this became part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This right includes freedom to change his religion or belief, and freedom, either alone or in community with others and in public and private, to manifest his religion or belief in teaching, practices, worship, and observance. The East eastern part of the world is believed. You have a right to share your faith with this article. I'm saying that's not what this article says. The western world says, yes, it's exactly what it says. So when Samuel Huntington writes his Class of Civilizations, he's saying there's this international divide. And in order to secure world peace, the western world must take a step back, must compromise in order to meet the rest of the world where it's at. You see where I'm going with this? It's a huge danger to religious freedom as we know it. Article 19, which is the International Free Speech Clause, says everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers or borders. That's pretty powerful. Now, when you consider that Russia has now adopted blasphemy laws, and you consider that Egypt has done it, and Romania, by the way, is about to do it. In fact, it has it already in its constitution. In Article 30 and Article 29 and 30, their religious freedom article and their free speech article, all right here. They have a clause in there that says if you speak meanly, negatively about another religion, that's a violation of this religious freedom standard, which seems to be a total contradiction. In fact, the beginning of the religious freedom clause says you can do and say anything you want because you have that religious freedom, have a right to free speech. And then they contradict that with an article below, a clause below that. So it's all very fascinating. The world seems to be going the wrong direction. And what I'm trying to share with you today is that not only is it going in the wrong direction, but we face prophetically. When we look at Revelation 17, we face prophetically a movement whereby if this so-called picture of world peace that Samuel Huntington brings about is taken seriously by most of the academic world, which it is, and it's taken seriously by presidents and popes, where are we headed prophetically? Revelation 17 tells us. The ten horns you saw are ten kings. That's not just Europe. That's the G20. That's the economic big powers of the world who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. This beast is both the lamb-like beast and the first beast of Rome of Revelation 13. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will wage war against the lamb. The Lamb will triumph over them because he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings. And with him will be his called, chosen, faithful followers. When I look at Romania and the situation there, my speeches at the town hall meetings, all 15 of them, were focused on you have a wonderful, splendid written constitution, but you adhere to the idea of religious tolerance. That is, you rely on the goodwill of the Romanian Orthodox Church, which is 90% of the people. You rely on the goodwill for burials in their cemeteries and elsewhere. You rely on the goodwill of the church. But if that goodwill is withdrawn, the Romanian Orthodox priests during my meetings, they would say, well, we get along just great. And I said, well, what about when you don't get along just great? And then they gave an opening to some of the Adventist pastors, Pentecostal Baptists, to talk about burial right issues and other issues within their practices between them and their understanding, saying, yeah, but we depend on your goodwill. What if that goodwill is withdrawn? We don't have any constitutional guarantee that really protects us, at least in practice. We have the constitutional guarantee in writing, but it doesn't protect us in practice. So they practice tolerance, and they ignore their constitution. Well, we both believe in not only understanding the constitution, but adhering to it in practice. Yes, there's problems here in the U.S., and I did point that out. I did admit we have problems in the U.S., clearly, between the right and the left. At least it's a discussion. It's an open public debate. They're afraid to say anything, to question the Orthodox Church. So these meetings that we had at Town Hall really was a new experience for many of these cities. Because, you know, they don't often get that opportunity to have that kind of dialogue, and a serious dialogue, and it could put the reputation of many of those the Evans Church online with the Orthodox Church. It was very risky. They still live under that fear of the big strong man, authoritarianism, and communism. Even though they're in a free country now, they still live with that fear. So they don't question too many things. They don't think for themselves many times because they're afraid to think for themselves. Let's just go along with the status quo. We have good. Let's keep it that way. So, friends, I believe that the phenomenon that I just shared with you is one that needs to be understood. We are living at the end of time. We're beginning to see a reversal of religious freedom around the world. We're beginning to see Christians and other people of faith persecuted and killed in huge numbers. The Pew Survey on Religion and Public Life did an international survey, and they said, and also along with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, they said, you know, international religious freedom is totally falling apart. Christianity is being persecuted, and they are being killed in all over the Middle East, whether it's Iraq, whether it's Jordan, whether it's Syria, especially Syria right now, Egypt. They're fleeing these countries in droves by the thousands, by the millions. And my fear is that it leads either to a continuation or a ratcheting up of this clash of civilizations where the United States has this mentality of a crusade mentality that, well, we see all this happening, let's get more, you know, powerful, let's speak out against this, and let's even go to war against that. We saw that in the Bush administration, kind of. But there's been a ratcheting of that back, pulling troops out of Iraq, now pulling troops out of Afghanistan, so that we don't appear to be crusaders anymore to the rest of the world. Thus, Obama's olive branch doctrine of foreign policy. So, with that withdrawal, are we then now starting to go a different direction in order to achieve world peace? If we're seeking world peace, how will we go about it? And do we give in to Glasgow laws? Let me say this one final thing. That if movies continue to be produced by radical right-wingers in this country, like the Innocence of Muslims, to stir up the Muslim community because of Christian right-wing hatred towards Muslims, if more and more of these movies come out, and more of these types of offensive things happen, which we continually see them happen, it will call for more and more for the world community to pressure the West to accept blasphemy laws. And that's problematic. It becomes more popular within the world community. The United States will be pressured by the world community to give in to that. Will we? I think prophetically, eventually, we do. And that's where I think we're headed. It seems like a grim picture. To close, verse 14 said it all. I went to school with Mark, and I really appreciate Mark over the years. And I encourage you give your life to Jesus and to keep your eyes open, to be discerning,